Hey, what's good, everyone? This is Rich.
And I'm Mark.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where we cover work and money for millennials and beyond and strive not to bore you to sleep.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances.
So first things first, if you didn't listen to last week's episode with Liz Weston, we encourage you to go back and check that out. Put that on your to-do list, your Evernote, your sticky pad thing, wherever it's got to go. It's a super fun episode with a lot of great info on credit and in particular credit scores. And we've gotten a lot of positive feedback about the episode overall. So definitely encouraging folks to go back and check that out if you didn't.
Yeah, I learned a lot on that one. Still don't consider myself a credit card or score expert, but I was surprised how much I learned coming away from that episode. The 100 credit scores, the MyFICO 8. I mean, if these things don't make sense to you, then this is why you should be tuning in. And just some of the urban legends that still continue to haunt the credit score card rumor arena, and some of which I think we're going to go over again today.
Yeah. And so also shout out to the 7 listeners that left us 5-star reviews over the past week on Apple Podcasts, FKA iTunes, FKA formerly known as. We've got Alan Dan 14, Keisha D 85, Married with 3 Kids, Godspeed to you, Ken P 2260, Brooke Craven, Bronco Grad 03, and Chucky Love, who left us the review of the week. And that reads,
as a 33-year-old male who didn't understand money and still struggle at it, it really helps to hear people who talk like me, black, millennial, humorous, and intelligent, talk about financial literacy and responsibility from perspectives that are really beneficial to young professionals. Some of us aren't around many who talk about these topics regularly. The barbershop? I'm going to put a pin in that. I'm going
to
come back.
I mean, I've been to the barbershop in years on years on years because reasons.
I'm actually going to put a pin in that, too, because I have a question for you. I've even listened to a few episodes more than once, exclamation mark, and a well-placed exclamation mark, I might add, from an earlier episode. A must subscribe to for anybody, and I always tell people this is one of my favorite podcasts for sure.
Appreciate that, Chucky Love.
So question number one was, so it's kind of funny. My barbershop, my barber has my book sitting behind him now. So debt free or die trying plug is so I get a lot of questions about that, which are interesting and run the gamut. I also get a lot of unsolicited advice about that.
Really?
Yeah. About what I need to do with my book and what I need to do next. That being said, one of the ones that I did take away from that was to put a class together, which I am working on behind the scenes. Very slowly and procrastinatedly, but it is getting done. I'm trying to write a chapter or a course or a module. I'm not really sure what to describe it as yet. A weekend. So, yeah, slowly but surely, progress.
Make not some progress.
Yeah, you know, all you can do. And then my second one was, so you don't go to the bar. Do you shave your own head?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it for years because reasons. So, I mean, so here's what I'll say. When I lived in New York City a few years back, I would occasionally go to the barbershop just to get the beard lined up and whatnot. I haven't really found anyone out here in California that I trust for that. And I guess full disclosure, I haven't really looked that much either. But I do know a lot of the black folks are like 40 miles away from where I live. And I'm not going that far just to get my beard lined up. But yeah, I mean, I've been like shaving my own head, lining myself up, which sometimes isn't satisfactory based on the looks that I get from Boobookins. But yeah, I've been doing it all on my own for like years now.
And I'm actually over here trying to fight. I'm not even sure if I'm going to drop it in the show notes, but the most popular, and for some reason this irritates me some type of way, the most popular video that I dropped back in the day as a Wisdom is Misery was a haircut video for shaving your own head. It got like, it's like 8,000 views or something.
Wait,
like that.
Did it really?
23,891 views 4 years ago. Wall bald fader product review, shaving without a razor. This is my most popular video ever. 23,000 views.
Well, you know what? It makes sense because I heard someone say that YouTube is like the second best search engine in the world. Which,
yeah. And still getting like active comments. There was a comment on there from like, because I was looking it up one day. There was a comment on there from like 3 months ago. So it's still going. It's still out there. Wall bald fader product review. Shaving without a razor. I still have those clippers, by the way. I got them for free. So I'm hoping that ties back to the paychecks and balances here. And for those who didn't follow me that long, I actually started shaving my head because cheap. And so it was about $80 a month. I was saving $960 a year. I did the math over here. Y'all know how I like to do that on the side. And then I actually forgot what my head looked like growing hair back. A lot of people just thought I was completely bald. Like, they didn't know I was shaving my head. So that was also an interesting online experience. Like, people who followed me and then saw me. And I'm not saying I have as much hair as I used to. But I had, from going from no hair at all, like, I think they thought I had the Steve Harvey treatment or something like that, the LeBron system, the Jamie Foxx grow a hairline thing going. And nope, what is left of my hairline is all mine.
Well, at least you had a choice, man. I feel like, I mean, I had a choice too, and it was either ridicule or oh. And I chose oh. Just saying.
And if you've been enjoying the show beyond this discussion of haircuts, which I hope is relevant to someone in the audience, don't forget to subscribe and hit us with a review on Apple Podcasts, formerly known as iTunes. You know, every time you do FKA, I'm confused as hell is what you're talking about. So I'm glad you always spell it out. And if you don't know how, visit paychecksandbalances.com/review.
I don't know where I first saw it, but then I just started using it. Then I was like, wait, everyone probably doesn't know what that means. So hopefully that's cleared up now and going forward. So we're going to switch it up with the format today and start with the listener questions before sharing our conversation with another guest. So today's episode is sponsored by FreshBooks, the cloud accounting software for the moonlighters and side hustlers out there. And I recently submitted a question to their support team and got a speedy and thorough response from Batman. Yes, they actually let their support agents have nicknames, fam.
Nice. Yeah. The report you sent me was the P&L profit and loss. Very clean, very crisp. I'm still, for those of you out there, low tech. So the low techies unite. I even was able to navigate the FreshBooks, not the software yet, but the information that Rich sent me. So I have nothing but positive things to say. It's always good when I said this behind the scenes and I say it on the show. It's always good when you can feel good about positive comments from your sponsor versus just reading from the cue card.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the ones, FreshBooks, that I can make a positive comment about the sponsor that is not forced.
Thank you for pointing that out, good brother. Yes, and sir. So to get your free 30-day trial of the cloud accounting software that we're using today, visit paychecksandbalances.com/FreshBooks and enter paychecks and balances in the how did you hear about us section, and you'll hear a little bit more about FreshBooks later in the show. So today's listener question, I'm feeling real Sylvester suffering succotash with the way I'm enunciating today, but I'm going to just go with it.
It happens.
And so today's question comes from D, and it's, should I stay at this job until I'm debt free? And so she says, hey guys, the question I have is if I should stay in a job that I don't like until I pay off all my debt. I'm in my late 20s and I'll make $70,000 this year and I have $28,000 in credit card debt. The credit cards have been cut, dipped in lighter fluid, and thrown into a fire pit. I wonder if she put a rub on them too. I've been using only cash and started budgeting. Nice. That's sounding pretty responsible so far.
It does.
The job that I currently work at pays well, but I don't enjoy the work or people. I've been with the company for a couple years and only stayed with them because I was told that there would be future opportunities in my field. As of right now, I don't see that happening in the near future, and I feel the longer I stay, the further away I'll get from doing the work I actually want to do. That's an awful feeling. I've had that before.
Yes, sir.
I don't know if I should go ahead and leave or stay until I'm debt-free. Another thing is that my job provides housing and transportation, the additional cost that I would have if I switch jobs. Either way, I'm going to leave. Just don't know if I should leave sooner rather than later. Any advice would be great. Thanks. I don't know why I chose to go with the high octave thanks, but anyway.
It did have an exclamation mark. I just want to point that out.
It did.
I made some notes and I'm going to have to expand on these because I somehow overlooked the housing and transportation costs, which I would imagine, does she say where she's from? I don't think she does in here.
No, she doesn't.
Could be a significant burden. So that's definitely something our cost consideration to take into consideration. But what I'd say is, and I have learned, like you said, and I think you went through as well, is I wouldn't stay at a job just to become debt free. So the short answer is no. And of course, I'm going to give you the long answer as well, if you would like to listen. But it sounds like you're
they ain't
actually
got no
asking,
choice.
I mean, they can skip forward. They're like, oh, nope, I'm going to move on. Boop, boop, boop. Yeah, what's no, the next topic?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Go log into FreshBooks. Should I look for another job that matches or comes close to my current income? In which it sounds like the answer to that question is yes. Yeah. So not necessarily clear here, but if you are living paycheck, you'll need to find a job that matches your current income or cut back where you can. Sounds like you're already budgeting and using cash anyway. So I'm assuming that you've taken this into consideration. Might be saying this for the benefit of the listeners out there who are not. But if you've got a buffer month to month, then you might want to do what I did. And I think I did the exact calculation. I think I'm living on like 51% or something like that of as far as bills being covered. If you got that buffer, then you might want to look at the minimum amount of money you can live on, then find a job or jobs that is scalable. So in your instance or your case, you might have to add back in housing and transportation. That already wasn't covered for me, so that was already in my line items, if you will. Mm-hmm. So in this example, you might need a minimum. Mine was closer to, I think, $25,000, $22,000, something to that effect. But I'm just going to say, let's say you need a minimum of $30,000, and that's to cover all your needs and groceries, which I'm going to assume food is a need, but I'm going to throw that in there because sometimes people leave it out. You also want to account for taxes and health care. So I'll usually put about 25 or more percentage on top. So to get to a minimum after tax of about $30,000, I'm estimating, I don't need people writing me in with the exact math, about $50,000 gross income to get you back down to 30. And that should help cover taxes and health care, if not outright cover it. Then see if a job or jobs is scalable so you can immediately or soon be back to making $70,000. In fact, I actually talked to Rich offline when I was looking at work options when I was considering getting out of or going into data entry, getting out of audit. And this was, maybe 3 to 5 years ago now. And we had a good conversation around, well, do you want to make a horizontal or vertical move? Or start at the bottom again in a completely different field, but you might be able to move up faster. Those were things that I wasn't even taking into consideration because, like most people, I want to do this one for one job. I have one job now. So what's the next one job I can do? And as we talked about on the Slashers episode, that might not be the case.
The Slashers?
Yes. When you have multiple jobs, so data entry, slash.
Fam, I'm like, when did we talk about like serial killers, man?
Yo, I really thought you did it that way to make me explain the definition.
No, yo, I really could not remember what the Slasher episode was. I'm like, yo, what is this?
I was like, good segue off the backboard. Yeah. But anyway, so Slashers is like, you know, data entry by day, podcaster by night, / mixtapes on the side, / open up for summer 17, you know, the Slasher. So yeah, so it's like the person who's hitting you with every hustle they can think of on the Facebook. Nothing wrong with that. As long as your net or gross income is matching or scalable to the income you're going to leave at the one job. I think it's flawed, possibly to the point of completely inaccurate going forward, that we being millennials will just have one job. We'll do it for 35 years and then we'll retire. Nah. That's just not the case. One, I don't think that's going to be a business dynamic that can be sustainable in the future. And number two, I don't think that's a business or professional dynamic that people want in the future. As best I can tell, most millennials, and I think it slows down, you know, with kids, age, life around 30s, 40s. Then you might get back to, you know, one or two jobs, one job, a side hustle, and a hobby. But I think 20s, most people are going to be moving. And I think the statistics support it every 2-3 years. Yeah. I think that might slow down to 3 to 5 in the 30s. And then I think our generation, maybe in our 40s and 50s, will then work that one or two jobs for the next 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. And I think some of that depends on where you fall in the organization, because if you're a manager and you're bouncing around every 1 to 2 years, it's going to be very hard for you to get opportunities, because the more senior you become, it's expected the longer you're going to stick around because of the just like the scope of responsibility and everything that you're going to be responsible for. And also the time it takes to search for somebody in a higher level position. So it's almost like the more senior the position gets, I think usually the longer the search for it is. And so, yeah, you know, once we're in our 40s and 50s, we're probably going to be in positions, you know, 5, 7 years. Maybe 10 years,
nice maybe catch, 10 nice years, catch.
I think the other thing is, as you move up, there's like less room to move up further versus when you start, you know, entry level, and then you go from junior to mid to senior to manager to senior manager to director. But that also depends on the size of the company that you're working into, because that path may look a lot shorter if you're working somewhere that's much smaller.
Yeah, and I think it sounds like here, and I don't want to assume, but I know this will apply to someone in the listening audience. I think when you do a present company included, when you do a W-2 job, you know, a standard 9-to-5, you get into the habit of that's the only job that you'll ever do. And I think what happens is it takes a complete change in mindset to say, hey, you know, now I have marketable skills. I've been doing this for 10 years. You know, they say you're an expert after 10 years or however many thousands of hours.
10,000 hours.
Yeah, you can start charging potentially if you have marketable skills. Now you are the consultant, or you can become the contract worker. So what 1099 work can you do? What writing can you do? What other consulting, assuming it is allowed by your job, not supporting moonlighting and doing something completely illegal behind the scenes. But, you know, in full disclosure to your job, hey, I'm going to start doing this on the side. Is that okay? Is that supported? What disclosure or paperwork do I need to fill out? But I don't think a lot of people think like that until they're already there. And I actually don't even think it happens that way. I think most people, present company again included, is I'm just sitting here going to my day-to-day life and somebody comes and says, hey, how much do you charge for that? I'm like, what is that? They're like, what you're doing right now? I'm like, this conversation? They're like, yes, I would pay you to do that. I'm like, oh, I have no idea, because I was not even thinking like that. And again, it's forward thinking. And I think having that type of thought process also makes it easier, because there's a light at the end of the tunnel. You start thinking about what that parachute looks like. And so it's more of a transition or a pivot, which I seem to think is some kind of really popular term, because I've seen people using it lately, even though I didn't even know what it means. I think I'm using it correctly. So what is going to be your pivot into that next career field, or what is an extension of your current profession that you could do separately or on the side?
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about consulting being the fastest way to make money outside of your day job or as an entrepreneur. But the thing is, if you're a consultant, there's a direct correlation between time and money. So it's not one of those things where you're like, oh, I'm going to consult and I'm going to come out the blocks making $1,000 an hour. I mean, maybe there's someone that can do that. But for most people, they're going to start at a much more reasonable rate until they build up their client base. But I've definitely heard that that's one of the faster ways to make money. And interesting point about jobs allowing people to do stuff on the side. Do you think that that's something that people should ask about during the interview process, or wait till they get on board and then figure it out later?
I would wait till, well, let me answer that two different ways. If you already have a job, I would disclose it and say, is that going to be an issue? So I podcast on the side. Is that going to be a problem? Most times they're going to say no. Now, if it's a direct conflict, like I podcast and I do sponsorship with a competitor of yours, they might have an issue with that. But most of the times I've told folks, hey, I wrote a book in 2016. So that happened before I got here. I'm going to still support and do what I need to do to move units, because that's what I did before. And you're not going to stop me. So this is a deal breaker on my side that I'm actually disclosing it for my benefit. And 9 times out of 10, actually, in this case, 10 times out of 10, they're like, okay, we don't even care. Actually, they're more like, we don't even care, and we appreciate the disclosure and you being upfront and transparent about that. In another scenario, let's say you're about to start a job. You don't have any contract work. You don't have any clients. It's something you want to do in the future. Hey, you know what? That's in your head. It's a dream, a goal, a fantasy. I would not disclose that. I would get onboarded and hired, because I also feel that even if that is in the black and white and the policies and procedures, standard operating procedures, contract, or whatever else you may be signing, when people get to work with you, they become far more amenable to, hey, this person's, I know Rich, and I know Rich wouldn't do anything to put the company in jeopardy, so we'll find a way to make this work, versus, hey, this is some guy that I'm hiring, a guy or girl that I'm hiring off the streets. I don't know them very well. They're disclosing this weird thing. I don't know what podcasts are. They scare me, so I'm not going to hire them. You know, like, that's why I would wait till I'm onboarded if it's something I haven't already initiated.
Yeah, I don't think I would disclose it either. And that's me saying that even as an HR and recruiter, I feel like I'm supposed to tell people that you should disclose that, but I wouldn't. And I actually didn't disclose that I did anything online until this current job. And that was within the last couple of years, where I was like, you know what? I'm tired of having to hide behind the stuff that I'm doing outside of work. I'm tired of having to hide things that I'm proud of. I'm just going to have to put this out there. If it creates an issue, then maybe I need to go somewhere else. where I'm going to have this type of freedom. And I think I've gotten to a point where I don't feel like that tied to the job. Now, of course, I need day job money, but I feel like if I really needed to go somewhere else, I could go somewhere else and I could get an interview and I could probably find a new job within a matter of a few weeks or within a matter of a few months in Silicon Valley. So I got to a point where I was like, you know what? If I'm not allowed to do this here, then I'm going to find somewhere else where I do have this freedom to do this thing that I'm really passionate about outside of work. So I don't have that worry. But yeah, I wouldn't go into an interview and be like, so, you know, I'm also a blogger, podcaster, just want to make sure that I can drop this episode weekly without any issues. I would save that for another time or not bring it up altogether, unless it falls into that box you mentioned where it's a direct conflict. So if you're working for an insurance company and then you're selling insurance services on the side, probably don't want to do that. Direct conflict of interest.
Yeah. And thanks for saying that, because something else I forgot about, maybe two other areas. Number one is it a hobby? So one of my saving graces, I would say, and I don't even know that I really needed one. Yeah, I didn't disclose that I blogged ever, or that I, until now. I kind of have to now, because the book literally on the first page says, visit Paychecks and Balances and debtfreeyourdietrying.com. So it's not very well hidden, and it's on Amazon, and you can literally preview that page. So I would probably have some transparency cover, because I do disclose that I read the book, that I wrote the book, and that if you do read the book, maybe my cover is, well, if you had read the book, it would say right there what the two websites are. But that being said, beforehand, I didn't make any money. So it was more of a hobby. So I don't feel that you have to disclose hobbies, period. The difference now is that I've incorporated, and I'm thinking about incorporating personally. So I have a true tax paying business. And so I think that puts you in a different umbrella. Same thing with if you were a contract, like you are actively signing contracts on the line as a 1099 or whatever the case may be, worker. I think that puts you in a different light that you need to disclose versus, hey, I'm doing something on the side that eventually I would like to do, you know, professionally or full time or as a job. If you're not already doing it, I feel that you would be okay. I guess I'm saying it's a personal choice to disclose at that point. Like if I went around disclosing all my hobbies, let me just put this another way. That is not something I'm going to do.
Yeah, I actually got to a point where I put the podcast stuff, it's on my LinkedIn profile. Now, I don't go into too much detail there because I realize it would have been confusing me as a recruiter reaching out to people and then they're seeing the podcast stuff. But it is at least on there, so it's very clear to anyone that's contacting me about opportunities, not that I'm thinking about leaving, that this is important to me. It's something that I do, and if you want to go listen to it and you have an issue with it, then we aren't meant to work together and I'm not meant to work where you are. So any other thoughts on the question specifically? Because I did have some on my side too.
No, not specifically, but that's an excellent point. And I just realized that both the book and the podcast are on my LinkedIn. So that's another way I feel that you can disclose without disclosing.
Yeah.
So if you have your resume and you provide it and it says right there, like mine does, here's my LinkedIn profile, here's a hyperlink, and they choose or choose not to click it, and they choose or choose not to read it, because it takes a little bit of a scrolling, then, hey, it's out there. There's some type of transparency threshold that I believe has been met simply by putting that information readily available in the public sphere.
Agreed. And so I, too, don't think she should stay at the job until she's debt free. It actually sounds kind of miserable. And what I think may eventually happen is whatever shield she's putting up to appear happy and tolerable and pleasant to work with, eventually that's going to crash to the ground and everyone's going to learn how she really feels. And then that's going to go from, I was here, I did my work, I was pleasant to work with, to everyone knew I wanted to leave, and now I've burned bridges. Because I've seen that. I actually heard a story of somebody who had a meltdown at work because they stayed around too long despite the fact that they hated the job and they wanted to go elsewhere. And they actually went out on one of those blazing, fuck you all, I'm out type of meltdowns. Like, ouch. Walked out, slammed the door. And someone was looking at hiring this person and did a backdoor reference and found out that this person had that meltdown at a previous job and ended up not hiring him. So like stuff like that. I mean, the chance of someone having a major meltdown at work, I'd say is pretty low. But when you say you don't like the environment and you don't like the people and you don't like the work, it's like, why are you really there?
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah. And the other thing is I'm glad that she did mention the housing and transportation piece of it, because that's going to help her determine the total compensation she needs to make for a seamless exit. And so though I wouldn't recommend saying I now need to pay for housing as part of the negotiation with whatever company you're looking at moving to or considering moving to. And I've had people do that where they say, oh, I'm going to have to pay for this. And I'm like, well, that's not my problem. Like, I mean, everyone has to pay for rent. How you pay for these things is ultimately on you. But I would add the amount of the housing and transportation benefits to total compensation to get an accurate idea of where she is today and to set a compensation floor that's going to be above the actual number that she needs to live today. So simplifying that, because I realize it might be confusing. There's a number that she knows that she needs to live today, and that's going to include the housing cost and whatever other benefits, and that's going to be her total compensation number. But then as far as negotiation for the next salary, she should set the floor for what she'll accept above what that actual minimum number is that she needs today. And so having that information handy will be helpful with that, because sometimes I don't think people think about some of these ancillary benefits until after they've signed the offer letter, where they're like, oh, crap, now I'm going to have to pay for lunch every day. Crap, now I'm going to have to pay for my Metro card. Now I'm going to have to pay for rent. Now I'm going to have to pay for this other thing that's been free to me this whole time. And so I do think it's fair to add stuff like that into total compensation, because there is a value to it and it's not something that's going to be available elsewhere. And now it is going to result in more money coming out of your pocket. You want to make it more about the compensation and less about the now I have to pay rent, now I have to pay this expense, because most times companies aren't going to really care about that. Any thoughts on that part?
No, I agree. I think that's definitely something I have to take in consideration going forward.
Cool. And then the other thing, I'm not sure if she has a performance bonus, but let's say she gets a 10% bonus and she's making 7K right now, she's making 70K right now. So that's going to probably be a 7K bonus, assuming she meets expectations. If she's at one of those places where she can max up the bonus and get, 15%, great. But that she's probably going to land somewhere in terms of what she's going to get after tax. It's probably going to be somewhere $4,000 to $4,500. I guess it depends on where she lives and so on. And that's going to be money that she'll be able to apply directly to her debt. And this is also assuming that they're on a calendar schedule. So maybe she would get her bonus in January. So it's already June at this point. Yes, staying another 6 months sounds like it would totally suck. But if she did have to stick around, she would at least have that chunk of cash in the new year, ideally, to put toward her debt and then immediately be out thereafter. Because also at the beginning of the year is when recruiters become more active, companies have new budgets to hire, and companies know people are getting their bonuses. And thus, if they were thinking about leaving, now they're definitely going to be ready to leave. So the whole tax thing, I was like, is it $3,500 that she would have afterwards? Is it $4,000? Is it $4,500? Do you have a rule of thumb for how you think about, well, have you worked somewhere where you've gotten bonuses?
I have not.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but I wasn't saying that to be an ass. It just occurred to me that like you've worked primarily in the government sector and things work a little different.
Yeah. I've gotten merits either one time or cost of living adjustments, but I haven't had bonuses. But I do want to put it out there. Now, I'm not going to be able to go into an in-depth discussion. So my comment is going, like I say, sometimes at work and in life, when I finish this sentence, it's going to be all I know and all I can answer. So sometimes, actually, as Financial Samurai, I just want to say that it's a possibility. He negotiated his bonus. So he would probably listen to this episode, or he negotiated his compensation package for exiting. He might listen to this episode and say, hey, why aren't they even talking about that? And I would say that's because that's such a reality that I can't even relate to it or articulate that this is ending this sentence is all I can say. And now you know as much as I know.
Yeah. Oh, and one other thing I would mention about switching jobs, especially when you get into the second half of the year, a lot of people don't think about whatever bonus they will forego by leaving that job. So it's just something to think about. So for example, let's say you get a 10% performance bonus. I'll just use that for simplicity's sake. And let's say you make 100K. And so that's $10,000 you know that you're supposed to be getting in January. And if you're moving to a job where maybe you don't get a very substantial base increase, and maybe you're eligible for a prorated bonus that's going to be much smaller, or maybe they don't have a bonus at all, you want to make sure that they know that you feel that you're leaving money on the table and they need to make you whole for that. Now, they may not always do that, but it's a good negotiation point, and it's something that I run into a lot out here in Silicon Valley, and I'm sure people run into that in other cities as well. So that does count. Even if you're supposed to get the bonus in January of the next year, you should be making the company know. If you're not already including that in your total compensation number, you should let whatever company you're interviewing with or going to the offer stage with know that you are also considering the money that you're going to forego by switching jobs at this time in the year. So that's probably the last thing I would add for this question. Anything else from you, good brother?
That's an excellent point. And just one last thing. It's more of a, frankly, a mental exercise. But I think it sounds like when you're at the point, and I've gotten close, it's definitely been a while where I don't like the job, the people, or what I'm doing. I mean, that's the trifecta. That's the trifecta you try to avoid as you work through that tripod of issues. But sometimes it has definitely been helpful for me just to have the mental light at the end of the tunnel. So I can say, you know what, I'm leaving in 12 months. And then it's more, that's the finish line. And what do I need to do to exit in 12 months? So over the next 3 months, I'm going to pay down my debt, $3,000. I'm going to raise my credit score 50 points. And then I'm going to refinance this credit card and put it on a zero balance transfer. That's going to take care of my debt. Boom. I need to put this amount of money to the side because I want to leave this job. I might be unemployed for 3 to 6 months. I'm going to put, $10,000 to the side to help me make ends meet. That will give me 6 months to live on. But if at minimum, I'm only planning to be unemployed for 3 months. Boom. And so it gives me a way to chronologically and with clear checkpoints. Here's what needs to happen at 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and I'm out of here at 12 months. Now, what I'm not saying is to have one of those, I'm out of here for you all at the 12 month point. But I have found that has made my day to day more peaceful, even in jobs that I didn't want to be in, because I'm like, hey, I'm out of here. All these other suckers are going to be here in the 13th month and I'm going to be gone in the 12th.
Or maybe the 13th if you're waiting for your bonus.
It may be.
Cool. So D, we hope we were able to answer your question over these 25 minutes that we've been answering this. And if you have questions that you'd like us to answer on the podcast or consider for answering on the podcast or on the blog, you can visit paychecksandbalances.com, hit the Ask PB button, or you can email us directly at info@paychecksandbalances.com. Anything coming up on the blog this week, good brother?
Yes, and I think it's actually related. When should I use a 401k loan to pay my bills and my debt? And I'll give you all a quick hint. Never. Tune into the blog to find out why. That'll be out Tuesday this week. Is that correct, brother? Same day as the podcast? We switching it up on y'all?
Yeah. So that'll be out Tuesday. Same day this episode is dropping. We also did get into this topic a bit with Liz Weston on last week's episode. So definitely, again, go back and check that out. So we're going to take a quick break to hear a little more about FreshBooks. After that, we'll jump right into our conversation with Matt Schultz, then come back to quickly close it out. So anything you want to fill the people in on before they hear the conversation with Matt?
A subject matter expert as far as credit cards go, and we'll probably try to sprinkle these in from time to time. So I wouldn't say it's a complex topic, but I know there are a lot of questions surrounding it. So if you have questions around credit cards, we always welcome those, debt management, and we definitely get them answered for you.
Cool, man. So we'll see you on the back half of the show. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Matt right after this message from our sponsor. Well, it's me reading a message for the sponsor. Anyway, here you go. You know what's nice? Being able to look in one place and see what invoices have been paid and who I need to holler at about my money. That's why we use FreshBooks, the cloud accounting software that makes accounting for unpaid funds super easy. You can follow up on invoices directly from the system and make notes so everything is in one place. No more logging into email, a Google Doc, and a service to get the info you need. To get a free 30-day trial of the cloud accounting software we use, visit paychecksandbalances.com/freshbooks and enter Paychecks and Balances in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Bye.
And today we're joined by Matt Schultz. Matt is a financial literacy advocate and credit card subject matter expert with a passion for helping people make smart decisions about their money. Matt has appeared on the CBS Evening News, the Today Show, CNBC, and hundreds of other TV and radio stations across the country, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and the Washington Post. If we haven't already convinced you, Matt's job is to make you smarter about credit so you can have the confidence and know-how to take control of your finances. We're happy to have him on the show, and thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Anything in that illustrious background that I might have missed or left off? Do you want the people to know?
No. I think you've covered it. I appreciate that.
So this time around, folks, we're going to get right into it. I want to talk a little bit about credit cards and millennials. So my opening question is, of course, what is the biggest mistake you see people? I'm going to say young people. I think millennials are still young. The jury's still out on that. We're now becoming older millennials. But what mistakes do you see people making when it comes to their credit cards?
Well, the biggest mistake that you can make is simply to not pay your bill on time and not pay enough of the bill when you're doing it. So job number one for anyone with a card is to pay your bill on time every single month, and ideally to pay it off in full. Now, we know that whether you're 25 or 85, that's not always possible. But the important thing is to remember that you have to pay more than the minimum on that card, because otherwise you're just asking for trouble.
I know that pain.
I do too.
I've actually heard some advice. So let's say you're going to carry it from month to month. Is there any benefits that you've seen to paying it earlier than the due date? Is that an urban legend?
It can help to pay earlier than the due date, or even to pay twice. Because with your credit score, generally, your credit is a snapshot of your finances at a moment in time. So just because you don't carry a balance each month with your credit card, that doesn't mean that you're going to show up with a zero balance on, in your credit report when your credit gets pulled. And because it's just a matter of timing. So the best way to kind of hedge your bets a little bit as far as timing those things is to pay maybe half of it on the 15th, half of it on the 1st, that sort of thing. And that way you can make sure that your balances are always fairly low.
I like that. Are there any other, maybe a top three or any other urban legends that you think are you've heard that people believe but are just either blatantly untrue or just popular misconceptions?
Well, one that always pops up is that people think that it's good for their credit for them to carry some sort of balance and to not pay their balance off in full. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard that myth, and it's just not correct. The best thing that you can do for your credit is to pay your bill in full every month. And what it really gets down to is that people overthink credit. I mean, there are lots of nuances and there are lots of little details to it. But when you get right down to it, all credit is paying your bills on time every time, keeping your balance as low as you possibly can, and not going too crazy applying for too much credit too often. If you do those three things and just lather, rinse, repeat over the course of years, your credit's going to be just fine.
Cool, cool. And so on a recent episode, PP56, for our regular listeners, we chatted with Liz Weston, who's a certified financial planner. And we learned that a missed payment can lower your score up to 100 points, maybe even more than that. So what other positive or even bad habits impact people's credit scores the most or the least? Are there things that come to mind for you?
Well, Liz is very smart, and she was right on with that. One thing that's important to know with that is that the better your credit is, the bigger the hit's going to be if you make a mistake with a late payment. So if you're at 650, it may not take your score down 100 points, but if you're at 750 or 800, it absolutely could. And one big mistake that people make is not leveraging technology because really with autopay, whether you do it through the bank where you have your checking account or through the credit card issuer, autopay means that you should never, ever be late with a credit card payment. And if you do that sort of thing and you set that up and set it to pay more than the minimum, you should never have to worry about that sort of thing.
And let me ask you, because that was a good point. It's actually something I'm personally dealing with. So when I moved across or down or somewhere from Colorado to Texas, yeah, I'm like, okay, wait, I was looking at, I had the map in my head. I'm like, southeast? when I came from Colorado back to Texas, I sold everything there. Bought all my furniture, 0% interest, same as cash. Thought I was doing it big. And my credit card tanked. And I got a car too. My credit card tanked because I was pinging it so many times. Is there a rule of thumb of what too many times is? And then do you have any insight? Because it felt like I had a high score. It's probably around 780. Went down like I think the lowest about 710. I'm about 730 now, but it seems like it's taking much longer to recover. So do you have any thoughts on like what I did poorly there so the people can learn, do as I did not do, but do as I say?
Yeah, well, I mean, the truth is that sometimes life is life and you got to do what you got to do and not worry about your credit. But really the thing to know is that applying for too much credit puts up some red flags because the bank will see all that activity and go, I wonder why he's getting all of that credit. Maybe that's a sign that he sees some dark clouds on the horizon or something like that. Generally, if you apply for two or three credit cards in the course of a year, you're going to be just fine. What you don't want to do is apply for a half dozen cards within the span of a couple weeks and then go out and apply for a mortgage and a car because it's just too much. So really the best advice is just to kind of just be aware of how much you're applying for. And especially if you're going to apply soon for something really big like a mortgage or a car loan, kind of lay low a little bit and try not to do anything that'll rock the boat too much in terms of your score.
Interesting, because I've heard that when you are applying for credit, so if you're looking for a credit card or you are looking to apply for, let's say, a car loan, that you should try to cluster all of those hard credit checks within a short amount of time, so it's a very clear story about what you were doing. And so with what you're saying, are you saying it's okay if you're doing it to have a clustered amount of pings or hard credit checks around one thing, but you shouldn't be doing it around multiple things at the same time, like trying to buy a house and a car and get lines of credit?
That's basically correct. And car loans are viewed a little differently simply because they're just a little different animal. And there's a lot more kind of comparison shopping where you have to kind of put yourself out there and apply and see kind of what you get. And those are handled a little differently than credit cards are in terms of your credit scoring.
Got it.
That's actually good to know. Makes me feel better. So I want to talk a little bit about credit history as well. So I think we're speaking to folks that have credit or maybe are building towards a home or a car payment. What if you have, and I was actually surprised by it. I don't remember the exact odds, but I read an article that said, like, you know, you always hear about these things about millennials, but it was like over 50% of millennials don't even have a credit card, which surprised me because I just assumed we all did. I just assumed everyone was as poorly managing it in their 20s as I am, and now they're trying to recover it in their 30s. But like 50% of us don't even have one.
I thought that if you everyone want to, got their credit card that first day of college when they walked on campus and got the Frisbee.
Exactly.
That's where I was too.
I came with the scholarship. So let's say today you're 25, 30, whatever the case may be. You want to start your credit history today. What's the easiest way to build and start on a positive route with no credit history?
The easiest way to get started with a credit history while also minimizing the risk involved is with a secured credit card. And all a secured credit card means is that you have to put a little bit of money down with the credit card issuer to establish the credit limit, and then it's yours, and it basically acts like any other credit card would. What this does is it makes it to where you don't have to get mom or dad or whoever to co-sign on a card with you. And you don't have to worry about getting a, you know, $1,000-$5,000 credit limit that you're just going to blow through. Get this secured card. You put down $200, something like that, to establish a little bit of a credit limit. Then you use it on a regular basis, spend a little bit on it, pay it off every month, and all of that good history will be reported to the credit bureaus. Then you kind of, you know, do your thing for 6-9 months, maybe a year. And then eventually, after you've established that good credit history, you can probably graduate to a little better card in one that is not secured. So you wouldn't have to put that deposit down. And it would also probably have better terms, better rewards, that sort of thing.
And what about your thoughts on building credit as a couple for those of us in serious relationships, or they at least appear to be serious at the moment? any pros, cons, or risk with adding partners with a lower credit score to your line of credit or a credit card? Because I hear a lot of situations where people do that. They're like, oh, my wife, fiance, husband, boyfriend, they had lower credit, so I wanted to help them out, so I added them to my card.
Yeah, there's a little bit of buyer beware in there, because your good deed, the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? What you're trying to do by making your loved one an authorized user on your card to help their credit can potentially end up backfiring on you a little bit, because if you make someone an authorized user on a card, the most important thing that people need to know is that that authorized user is not legally liable to have to pay those bills that they run up. You, the primary account holder, are the one who is responsible for that. So you need to make pretty darn sure that that your girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, is going to handle their business. Otherwise, it can get a little dicey.
Very risky indeed.
I did not know that. Sounds like the secured card might be the way to go in the future, for future Marcus.
Yeah, I was going to say, it'll be like, oh, can you put me, how about we get you signed up for a secure card? How about we start there, baby?
I got you the aluminum card. Speaking of which, is it true, and I honestly cannot figure out the root to this rumor, I don't know if it's a rumor or fact, but does everything stay on your credit report for 7 years? Is it some things? Is it no things? Like, what's the rule here?
Good things, good history stays on your card for 10 years. Bad generally stays on for 7. But the good news is that generally speaking, a mistake that you make today will be less impactful on your credit score in 3 years than it will be in 5 years than it will be in seven. So that's at least a positive thing. And it's great that good history hangs around on your report for 10 years, because that means that you really do reap the benefits of handling your business well for quite some time.
So as far as, let's say, debt management, let's say you've gotten into some problems, how can either credit cards, balance transfers, or consolidation loans, if you have thoughts on those, and I have some follow-up questions if you do, be used to improve moving into positive credit habits?
Well, right now is a pretty great time to do balance transfers on a card, assuming that you have good enough credit to get that card, because we're seeing 0% introductory periods that are 15 months, 18 months, even 21 months. So almost 2 years without paying any interest. And that's a really long time, and can make for really significant savings. So those tools can be really useful as long as you know what you're getting into, and you understand that there are fees, there might be some deadlines involved, and generally as long as you play by the rules of the game.
Yeah, I've taken a look at that, and I probably need to do some additional analysis on the break-even point. But have you had any conversations or seen any analysis on when does the transfer fee itself, make it not a good balance transfer offer, even if it is 18 or 21 months, 0% interest?
Well, generally, if you're talking about 18, 21 months, then it's absolutely still worth doing, because you're talking about 3, 4, 5% as that balance transfer fee. And if you're making that trade-off to save 2 years almost worth of 20, 25% interest rate, then the math on that's pretty easy. And that makes for a pretty good deal.
Okay, that's good to hear. So speaking of which, bankratecreditcards.com, how can the people use these websites in choosing the best credit cards for them?
Well, we have hundreds of offers from virtually every card issuer out there, certainly all the major ones. And we have a tool called Card Match, which we provide to help kind of steer people towards cards that are best for them. So you give us a little bit of information, name, address, that sort of thing. And honestly, the last 4 digits of your social security number, and we do a soft pull on your credit. And then we use that information to show you cards that you are likely to be a fit for. There's no impact on your credit score. We don't keep that social security number. And we do our best to kind of show you the best cards that are a fit for you. And then other tools that we have an app called Score and Report that helps you keep up with your credit score and your report on a regular basis. We also have an app called Wallet, which is cool because when you put your credit card information into that app and walk into a store, we tell you which card in your wallet is the best one for you to use to get the most rewards for your buck at that particular location. So we got lots of tools out there to help people out.
Nice.
Nice. And I'll get that into the show note, folks. Don't go scribbling and jumping over to Google. So how do you feel about services for either protecting your identity or your credit? No plug, but the one that comes to mind, I guess they have a great marketing strategy, is LifeLock. Are these services you find typically worth it for preventing theft prevent unauthorized use?
They can be. Sometimes it's a matter of kind of what makes people feel better. And that, you know, there's value in that as well. But the truth is that a lot of these monitoring services are things that you can kind of do yourself in terms of keeping an eye on your credit report, keeping an eye on your bank statement to make sure that nothing strange is out there. And then if something does happen, or if you're concerned after a particularly big breach, there are things that you can do to just lock down your credit to where nobody can apply. Things like a credit freeze, which is basically kind of like the nuclear option as far as protecting your credit. So I'm generally not the biggest fan of those sorts of tools like LifeLock, but I also understand that they can bring people peace of mind.
I appreciate that. And I mean, full disclosure, I haven't used one before. I've just kind of thought about it. And I've kind of come to the same conclusions in that a lot of what I saw or read to date, I'm like, well, I feel that I would be comfortable doing this. I did even have my card compromised at one point. It sucked, but I got the money back, you know, 24 hours. I slept through the text alert. Actually, I think that was the time they emailed me. The one time they emailed me instead of texting me. So I slept through the email alert. But, you know, I haven't felt it rise to the need of why I need it to be monitored 24 hours a day, 365. Of course, I'll probably immediately regret that after the show. Account's probably being drained as we speak. but I want to clarify, we spoke to it a lot. We speak on it to a few shows. But is the only difference between a soft and a hard pull is that a hard pull will or does have an impact on your credit score? Or is there any more between a soft and a hard pull?
I mean, that's generally it from the consumer. It's just important for folks to know that that most of these websites that you go to, whether it's ours or one of our competitors or a credit, it's not going to impact your credit. It's not being seen as you being judged as to your credit worthiness. It's just a matter of you getting that information to help you make smart decisions.
Cool. And so unless you have anything else that you want to plug for Bankrate or credit cards, is there any social media websites that you want the people to know where they can find you?
Yeah, you can find creditcards.com on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at creditcards.com, and I'm on Twitter at Matthew Schultz, and also on Instagram at matt.schultz.
Awesome. Cool. Awesome. Yeah. And so we'll make sure that we get all of these links and all of this information into the show notes so that the listeners can follow up. But Matt, really appreciate you joining us on the podcast and dropping some knowledge for the people.
That was fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, he's quite knowledgeable in the credit domain.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So we hope you enjoyed that conversation with Matt. Also, the mailbag, the questions that we answered, or the question that we answered on today's episode, which was executive produced by PNB patrons Michael M., Mo S., Terrell C., and Stephanie S. To learn how to become an executive producer, get early access to episodes, and more, visit paychecksandbalances.com/patron, P-A-T-R-O-N.
And also don't forget to visit our website for show notes, our latest blog post, and to join our email list where we share helpful and interesting articles we read throughout the week, actionable work and money tips at paychecksandbalances.com.
There it is. So again, thanks to everyone for listening. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.